Chapter 3. What Stays in the Mind? Learning and Memory. When you learn something, it makes a difference. There is something you can do that you could not do before, like play the piano. Or there is something that you now know that you did not know before, like what empirical means. When something stays in the mind, we assume it is stored somewhere, and we call this storage system memory. The system does not work perfectly. We sometimes have to rack our brains or search our memories. But perhaps the most common preconception about what stays in the mind is that there is a place where it is all stored. Sometimes one cannot find what one wants, but it is probably there somewhere, if only one knew where to look. But psychologists' discoveries about learning and memory demonstrate that what is stored in the mind cannot be adequately understood by using the analogy of the repository. About memory, William James asked in Principles of Psychology from 1890, "Why should this absolute God-given faculty retain so much better the events of yesterday than those of last year, and best of all, those of an hour ago? Why, again, in old age, should its grasp of childhood's events seem firmest? Why should repeating an experience strengthen our recollection of it? Why should drugs, fevers, asphyxia, and excitement resuscitate things long since forgotten? Such peculiarities seem quite fantastic, and might, for aught we can see a priori, be the precise opposites of what they are. Evidently, then, the faculty does not exist absolutely, but works under conditions, and the quest of the conditions becomes the psychologist's most interesting task." Understanding what stays in the mind still presents challenges to psychologists. Their studies have revealed many odd facts. For example, both experimental work and clinical observations show that memories for distant events have different characteristics from memories for recent events. People suffering from amnesia may retain childhood memories, but find it almost impossible to acquire new memories, such as the names of people they have just met. Or they may remember how to tell the time, but not remember what year it is, or be able to learn the layout of a new home. For some, new learning appears to be impossible, even though they can accurately describe their childhoods and repeat back to you a line of poetry you have just recited. They may readily learn new motor skills like typing, yet deny having ever seen a word processor before. Although the source of the damage in such cases appears to be located in a specific part of the brain, the hippocampus, no storeroom where neural connections or networks of interconnected wires terminate has been found. The processes of learning and memory, which we use unthinkingly every day, are thus intimately connected and so complex that it has not yet proved possible to build a computer capable of simulating them accurately. We will start with learning to illustrate how psychologists understand the different ways in which learning makes a difference. Learning, making the connections that last. We tend to assume that the ability to learn is determined by such things as how clever you are, whether you pay attention, and whether you persist when the going gets tough. But it turns out that there are different kinds of learning, many of which do not involve conscious effort or formal instruction. We are learning all the time, even if we are not attempting to do so, and some of the ways in which we learn are similar to the ways in which other animals learn, despite our greater capacity. Human learning is triggered in a number of different ways. The environments into which babies are born vary so enormously, even in basics, such as how they are handled, fed, and kept warm, that adaptation is essential. Babies adapt so fast and so well because they are predisposed to learn, and because they respond particularly strongly to certain types of events, contingencies, what goes together with what, discrepancies, differences from the norm, and transactions, interactions with others. Learning about contingencies allows one to make things happen. Turn the tap and the water, usually, runs. By learning how to turn the tap on and off, we learn how to control the flow of water. Tiny babies repeatedly explore contingencies, waving their arms about. They hit something that makes a noise and do this over and over again until they can control the noise they make. This apparent fascination with contingencies is an important basis for other types of learning, such as skill learning. Once you have mastered a skill, you can do it without thinking and turn your attention to something else. When you can read words effortlessly, you can think about their meaning. If you can play the tune automatically, you can think about how to interpret the music. Once you know what to expect, then discrepancies become fascinating, provided they are not too radical. Small changes in a child's world, a new type of food, sleeping in a different place, invite exploration and help the child to learn. But if everything is suddenly disrupted, then the child becomes seriously distressed. In the same way, different ways of singing the song or playing the game become interesting once you know its basic pattern. This ability to learn by making distinctions is lasting and fundamental. Older people are better at new learning when they already have relevant stored knowledge and are therefore noticing and adjusting to discrepancies, but worse at learning something completely new. Transactions with others are necessary for survival for a human infant, and the way babies participate in these transactions, at first by crying and looking, and later by smiling and in more complex ways, enables them to learn about and control their worlds. A baby that cries when it needs something is engaged, however unknowingly, in a participation which influences others. It is not engaged in a power struggle, manipulating people for attention, but initiating a transaction that will help it to survive. If nobody responds, the baby eventually gives up and becomes apathetic, as if it had learned that there was no point. Babies, and indeed adults too, are particularly responsive to contingencies, discrepancies, and transactions. And these events trigger some of the basic processes involved in learning. Perhaps the most basic of the many different kinds of learning is association learning or conditioning. Classical conditioning was first explored and understood by Pavlov, working with dogs in the 1920s. Having found a way of measuring their salivation in response to food, he noticed that the dogs started to salivate before they were given the food. The reflexive or unconditioned response of salivation was triggered by things associated with the food, like the sight of the bowl, the person who brought the food, or the sound of the bell that was paired with the food or rung as the food appeared. Pavlov thought that virtually any stimulus could become a conditioned stimulus for salivation. The sound of a metronome, a triangle drawn on a large card, and even an electric shock. And he concluded that learning takes place when a previously neutral stimulus, say a bell, is associated with an unconditioned stimulus, or something to which we naturally respond, such as food. The variants, determinants, and limits of classical conditioning have been minutely studied, so we know how conditioned responses die away or generalize to similar things, how emotions can be conditioned, as in a child's fear of the waves, and counter-conditioned, as in by holding a parent's hand while paddling. And new associations can be made quite dramatically in one-trial learning, as when a particular food makes you sick and you never want to touch it again. Operant conditioning, first investigated by B.F. Skinner, explains the part played by reinforcement in learning. Operant conditioning provides a powerful means of controlling what people and animals learn and what they do. The main idea is that if an action is followed by a pleasant effect, it will be repeated, whether performed by a man or a rat. If pressing a lever brings with it a food pellet, a rat will learn to press the lever. The hungrier it is, the faster it will learn, and the strength of its response can be precisely predicted by the rate at which the food pellets are dispensed. The rat will work hardest if the pellets arrive intermittently and unpredictably, which is how fruit machines keep us hooked, and less hard if the pellets arrive after the same amount of time, whatever the rat does. Hence, people paid at a constant rate for doing boring, repetitive work quickly lose motivation in comparison to those paid piece rate. Using the principles of reinforcement, extraordinary feats of learning have been demonstrated, such as teaching pigeons to play table tennis with their beaks by shaping their behavior gradually in the right direction. Operant conditioning has many practical applications. If you want a response to continue after it has been learned, such as getting a child to tidy its room, you should reward it intermittently, not continuously. If you occasionally reward a behavior you want to decrease rather than increase, for example, angry outbursts or tantrums, you will strengthen the behavior by mistake. If a reward arrives too late, it will be far less effective, thanking an employee a week after you received their report rather than immediately. Reinforcement thus provides the fuel for the learning machine, which works equally well whether the reinforcer is positive in that it provides something pleasant or negative in that it takes away something unpleasant. If you miss the show, you learn to plan ahead. Skinner had strong views about punishment, which is easy to confuse with, but very different from, negative reinforcement. He believed that it was an ineffective way of helping people to learn, because it is painful but uninformative. It works by discouraging a particular kind of behavior without suggesting what to do instead. In fact, punishment raises complex issues. It can be effective, for example, in reducing the self-injurious behavior of some disturbed children, and it can be administered in mild but effective ways, a spray of water in the face or time out from the situation. But its effects may be temporary or only effective in specific circumstances. For instance, adolescents may smoke with their friends, but not in front of their parents. Punishment is not often easy to deliver immediately. It conveys little information and may be unintentionally rewarding. A teacher's reprimand to one naughty pupil may attract reinforcing kinds of attention from others in the class. Operant principles have been turned into effective behavior modification techniques in many settings such as schools, hospitals, and prisons. Theoretically, they provide the power to predict and control the behavior of others. Using this power for the purpose of toilet training is one thing, but using it for political purposes is another. One reason why this sort of abuse of power may not be the risk that was once feared is that there is room, psychologically speaking, for an element of determinism and for an element of free will in the sequence of events that leads up to a person's actions. Association learning is not the only possibility. If you notice that an advertiser is associating a new car with sexual potency, you can decide to take it or leave it on more rational grounds. If someone is nice to you for non-genuine motives, you may not find the contact rewarding, so the contingency may fail. Clearly, we can use other types of learning and other cognitive abilities as well. Observational learning, learning by imitating or watching others, provides a shortcut, which bypasses the need for trial and error and immediate reinforcement on which association learning depends. Much of the learning that takes place in schools is of this type, and it can also explain how we acquire attitudes and information about the social conventions of the community in which we live. Latent learning is learning that does not show up right away. If you have looked at a map of a new city or have traveled through it as a passenger, you will learn your way around it faster than someone who is completely new to it, and your learning advantage can be accurately measured. Insight learning occurs when you suddenly see the solution to a problem, how to fix the broken lamp. The understanding sometimes comes in a flash, and it is not clear whether it is purely the result of previous learning or whether it involves mentally combining old responses in new ways, as we do when we use the words in our language in new combinations so as to express our own ideas. Cognitive theories of learning have moved away from the associationist view and tried to explain the influences of other processes, such as attention, imagination, thinking, and feeling. As soon as we start to look at the ways in which new learning interacts with what is already in the mind, the distinction between learning and memory becomes blurred. Memory, like perception, is an active process and not just a tape recording of all that you have learned. The more use you make of the material you learn, such as reading a French newspaper, speaking and writing to a French friend, watching French films, or revising your grammar, the more you will remember. Material that is passively imbibed is easily forgotten, and the differences that learning makes to what stays in the mind can be more fully understood by exploring the determinants of what we remember, by finding out how our memory works. Observational learning, when others set a bad example. Bandura and Walters, in 1963, observed young children as they watched someone playing with some toys, in real life, on film, or as shown in a cartoon. Sometimes the person hit one of the dolls. The children were then taken to the same playroom to play with the toys, and some were frustrated by the experimenter removing the toy a child was playing with. Frustrated children tended to imitate the aggressive behavior they had observed and copied real-life models more closely than filmed or cartoon models. Further studies show that children are more likely to imitate models similar to themselves, children of the same age and sex, and people they admire. Memory, shadows, reflections, or reconstructions. The big issue about memory is still, how does it work? The following findings illustrate some of the difficulties. As early as 1932, Sir Frederick Bartlett showed that remembering is not just a question of making an accurate record of the information we receive, but involves fitting the new information into what is already there and creating a narrative that makes sense. The War of the Ghosts. In 1932, Bartlett read People an American Indian Legend, following which partly depended on understanding of unfamiliar beliefs about a spiritual world, and found that the errors they made when remembering it were not random, but systematic. In the legend, someone watches a battle involving ghosts, recounts what he saw to others, and then suddenly succumbs to a wound received from a ghost. People made sense of the unfamiliar material by fitting it into their pre-existing ideas and cultural expectations. For example, something black came out of his mouth was reproduced as escaping breath or foamed at the mouth. And the people in the story were assumed to be members of a clan called the Ghosts. Also, the changes they made when remembering the story fitted with the reactions and emotions they experienced when they first heard it. One subject said, "I wrote out the story mainly by following my own images." Bartlett argued that the process of retrieval involves reconstruction, which is influenced by the frameworks that people already have in their heads. So memory, just like perception, is both selective and interpretive. It involves construction as well as reconstruction. We are able to recall the meaning of events far more accurately than their details, and the meaning we give to them influences the details we remember. At the time of the Watergate trials, the psychologist Ulrich Neisser compared tape recordings of conversations held in the White House with reports of those conversations from one of the witnesses, John Dean, who had an exceptionally good memory. He found that the meaning of Dean's memories was accurate, but that the details, including some especially memorable phrases, were not. Dean was right about what happened, but wrong about the words used and the order in which topics were discussed. At particularly important or emotional moments, details tend to get better fixed in our memories. However, even then, the details remembered by two people present at the same event may be strikingly different. If I faced the blue sea and my husband faced the dark forest when we decided to marry each other, 20 years later, we can argue about where we were at the time and accuse each other of forgetting important shared memories because one of us remembers the darkness and the other remembers the light. Cormac McCarthy said in The Crossing, "The past is always an argument between counterclaimants." How we decide between counterclaimants is still an important issue. It is possible that people brought up in painful and distressing circumstances in which they felt neglected or victimized later remember accurately the meaning to them of the events in their childhoods, but are incorrect about the details. This could explain some instances of false memory syndrome, in which people are said to recover memories, for example, of being abused in some way as small children, that turn out not to be accurate. It is also possible that the details of unusual or intense experiences are accurately remembered. The mistake is to believe that remembering details and believing that those details are accurate prove that the memories are correct. Even when we do remember details accurately, the details we remember are not fixed in our memories, but remain changeable. If I witnessed an accident at a junction and am later questioned about details of what happened, such as whether the car stopped before or after the tree, I am likely to insert a tree into my memory, even if there was none. Once that tree has been inserted, it seems to become part of the original memory, so that I can no longer tell the difference between my real memory and what I remember remembering later. So memories once told can be changed by the telling, and questions asked of witnesses in court, such as, "Did you see a broken headlamp?" versus, "Did you see the broken headlamp?" affect what is recalled without people knowing that this has happened. People often wish for perfect or photographic memory. However, being unable to forget may have its disadvantages, and the creative, rather inaccurate system of remembering and forgetting that we have may be well adapted for our purposes. The mind of a mnemonist. Alexander Luria wrote in 1968, "One man was able to remember huge series of numbers or words after seeing them for only a few seconds. He could repeat them forwards or backwards even after a gap of 15 years. This man's memory appeared to work by making the information he received meaningful. He associated each part of it with visual and other sensory images, making the elements unique and unforgettable. But these images subsequently interfered so much with concentration that he could no longer perform simple activities, including holding conversations. and became unable to function in his profession as a journalist. The problem was that new information, such as the words he heard others speak, set off an uncontrollable train of distracting associations. How do models of memory account for findings as diverse as these? And what do they tell us about the function of memory? It has been proposed that three quite different kinds of memory store, which receive and lose track of information in different ways, are needed to account for observations about memory. The sensory store receives information from the senses, sights or sounds, and holds it in memory for about a second while we decide what to attend to. What we ignore is quickly lost and cannot be retrieved as it decays just as lights fade and sounds die away. One can sometimes catch an echo of what someone said when one was not paying attention, but literally a second later it has gone altogether. Paying attention to something transfers it to the short-term store, which has a capacity of about 7 items. So we can remember a new telephone number for about as long as it takes to dial it. The short-term store has limited capacity, and once full, old information is displaced by new. However, continuing to attend to, turn over in one's mind, or rehearse information transfers it to the long-term store, which supposedly has unlimited capacity. This seems to imply that information in the long-term store need never be lost if only one knew how to find it. Forgetting would occur because similar memories become confused and interfere with each other when we try to recall them. So, unless we have the mind of a mnemonist, one birthday party becomes confused with another, and what we remember in the end is something about the significance of birthdays, rather than exactly what happened when we were 5 or 10 or 15. General meanings are more important than details, unless something marks those details for us, a 21st birthday or a surprise party. So, how can you establish what really happened? Or do we even need to? Evolutionary considerations may help to explain why memory works as it does. Our memory systems did not evolve because we need to catalog the items and events in the world, but because we need to adapt our behavior. It seems that our minds, including our memories, adapt to fit our changing situations. There are things we need to remember, like how to read, what our friends are like, and what we have got to do next, and things we do not need to remember, like precise details of our past. Being hungry helps us to remember to buy something to eat, which is adaptive. If we are depressed, sad memories spring easier to mind, which may or may not be adaptive. It seems that having fragmentary memories, from which we can select according to our interests, and which we can organize in creative and useful ways, is sufficient. With a few cues, reminders, or partial fragments in mind, we can select, interpret, and integrate one thing with another so as to make use of what we learn and remember. Thinking along these lines has led contemporary psychologists to think of memory as an activity, not a thing, or as a set of activities involving complex encoding and retrieval systems, some of which are now amenable to separate study. These systems, like the perceptual system described in Chapter 2, employ organizing principles. Information stays in the mind more easily if, for example, it is relevant, distinctive in some way, has been elaborated upon or worked with, and processed meaningfully as opposed to superficially. Organizing information we want to remember confers an advantage when it comes to remembering it, thinking of picnic food or school lunches as you walk around the supermarket. Some general principles of organization have been discovered, But at the same time, each of us develops a personal organizational system based on past experience. So we encode or organize incoming information differently and have different priorities or interests when retrieving it. This helps us to adapt in the present, to avoid the people we find boring, and to seek out the kind of work that feels satisfying. But it also means that our memories are not just snapshots of the past. Just as we saw that perceiving and attending to the outside world helps us to construct a view of reality, so we now see that learning and memory are also active constructive processes. Furthermore, the accuracy of our memories may be irrelevant for many purposes. In order to make the best use of what stays in the mind, it may be more important to remember meanings and to learn how to find out the details than to remember precisely what happened.